This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Support for the world comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
A French school teacher shows his students a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad and is murdered. Many teachers in France now feel targeted.
You have hundreds of thousands of teachers who today think that, you know, this could happen to them.
Also today, Thailand cracks down hard on protesters, but it doesn't seem to matter.
Last night, I watched several thousand students block one of Bangkok's busiest roads.
And vintage Disney films like Peter Pan and Dumbo now come with a warning about culturally insensitive stereotypes. Some say that's not enough.
I don't think the impact on consumers, in this case kids, will be that significant.
Disney tries to fight racism. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being here this Monday. In France today, police have raided the homes of dozens of suspected Islamist radicals after the horrifying murder of a high school history teacher named Samuel Paty. Just a warning that this is a disturbing story. On Friday, an attacker went to Paty's school outside Paris and decapitated the teacher because he had shown controversial cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in class. Today, the French government also said it's investigating 51 French Muslim associations. If these groups are found to promote hatred, the government says they'll be shut down. In a moment, we'll hear concerns about the French government's response. First, though, we turn to Sylvie Kaufmann, the editorial director at Le Monde newspaper in Paris.
We have a constant attack on freedom of expression under its different forms. It's music, it's journalism, it's cartoons, and now it's teaching. And this professor belongs to, in France, it's the teachers of history and geography who also teach what we call civic education, which is basically the teaching of the values of the French Republic. And those values are freedom of expression, among others. And the vast majority of French Muslims also think they have this right to express themselves freely. And it's only this very small but extremely violent and radical minority disagrees with this. And, you know, this is what brings all those killings.
The French government announced that they are investigating 51 French Muslim associations today, as well as carrying out raids on Islamist extremists. What do you think that's going to accomplish?
There is this feeling that maybe the government was too soft on some associations, which under the pretense of, you know, just being community associations, in fact, were encouraging radical thinking or recruiting young people to conduct jihad. You know, we had a huge problem several years ago with young people who were being recruited by Islamic State to go to war in Syria. There is really a phenomenon, a very aggressive phenomenon of radical Islamist organization trying to sow division and even worse, I mean, terrorism in European society. Some of the associations which are being investigated now you know, are suspected of this. I'm not sure they will all be banned or whatever, but I guess they are investigated closely now, yes.
But don't moves like this by the French government, aggressive moves right now, don't they potentially risk making things worse, especially right now when feelings are so tense?
Public education is a big sector in France. The vast majority of people go to public school here. We have like 800,000 teachers. And I can tell you that they have very strong feelings at the moment. They are hurt. I mean, what happened on Friday is absolutely horrible. I mean, you know, you have hundreds of thousands of teachers who today think that, you know, this could happen to them and they have to be protected. Not only they themselves, but they also ask for protection and support in the way they are teaching. And this is the way they are asked to teach. You know, what this teacher was teaching, the course of civic education, is an official program of national education. He didn't set it up himself. He was just doing what he is paid for. So, you know, I think those teachers also know what are the limits of this aggressive policy, if you want, because they have
the aggressive
Muslim
policy going after
in
these
their
associations.
Classes. So they deal with this problem every day in their job. I don't think those teachers are too conservative or too aggressive or too nationalist or too or anti-Muslim. They are not. They just want the government to help them to do their work and lead a normal life in a diverse society.
Sylvie Kaufmann is the editorial director at Le Monde. She joined us from Paris. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Horror at the murder of Samuel Paty is shared in France's Muslim community.
Nothing whatsoever can justify that a man gets killed for showing a cartoon. Nothing. I tried the whole night last night to get my head around it. It doesn't click.
Yasser Louati is with the Justice and Liberties for All Committee and a prominent Muslim voice for human rights in France. He is appalled by Paty's murder. He's also critical of the response from French authorities.
He was a teacher, and from where I come from, they hold a sacred place because they teach and they get us out of ignorance. Now, people are mentioning the fact that he may have been insensitive or made a mistake. Regardless, absolutely nothing could have justified it. And it's even more worrisome since his name was dragged into the mud on social media for several days, if not weeks, and that he must have lived in a state of fear before he was beheaded. How can you go from a social media buzz to a person losing his life, him being beheaded in broad daylight? I have no word for it.
Yasser, following the killing, as you know, the French government announced that they are investigating 51 French Muslim associations today. They're also carrying out raids on Islamist extremists. Now, you're Muslim. What's your reaction to that move?
Whether I'm Muslim or not, or whether I practice this religion or not, does not matter. I'm a human rights and civil liberties activist, and I'm sincerely concerned over these authoritarian turns taken by the various administrations. This person who killed the teacher was reported multiple times, and most of the time he was reported by Muslims themselves, and nothing was done to prevent the attack. It's like we have another massive intelligence failure in a country that has been passing repressive laws for the past 25 years, in a country that has laws allowing mass surveillance. And the project to implement state-sponsored mass surveillance was sold to us as a means of protection. And my interpretation of this is that they are engaging in a one-upmanship as they are running for re-election, and that Emmanuel Macron wants to pose as the protector of the French nation. And the message being sent is that I'm going to protect the French nation, which does not include the millions of Muslims that are an integral part of it.
I mean, the climate now in France is so tense. It's been that way for a couple of years. The attacks on social media and elsewhere are filled with so much hatred. How can this tension be dialed back?
I think it's a responsibility that lies on our shoulders as citizens. We lost our freedoms on the one hand with these laws, and we are not safe from terrorist attacks. but we are bound to live the future together. Our kids are bound to grow up together, and we have no other choice but to live side by side.
Yasser Louati is a French human rights activist with the organization Justice and Liberties for All Committee. Thank you very much, Yasser, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Armenia and Azerbaijan reached a truce this weekend. It lasted just minutes. Fighting in the region of Nagorno-Karabakh is entering its third week. It's an area that both Armenia and Azerbaijan lay claim to. The conflict is also impacting people who are part of the Armenian and Azeri diaspora around the globe, reigniting a controversy they've both faced for years. Here's The World's Daniel Offman.
If there's one thing that doesn't seem to be controversial, it's this. Nagorno-Karabakh, with its rolling hills, alpine meadows, and cascading streams, is a beautiful place. But there's a deadly conflict playing out right now, and there's no room for compromise between the two opposing sides. Armenians have organized large protests from Paris all the way to Los Angeles.
What do we want?
Nothing.
When do we want it?
No!
Armenian protesters believe that Nagorno-Karabakh is their rightful territory, and that Azerbaijan, with Turkey's help, is trying to take it by force. Earlier this month, California Democrat Adam Schiff seemed to be sympathetic to the Armenian side.
We have a message for Azerbaijan. Cease the hostilities or there will be consequences.
But the hostilities continue. Hundreds of people are dead, and the conflict feels like a zero-sum game. Supporters of Azerbaijan are equally convinced that they're on the right side of history. Protesters from the Azeri diaspora say that Nagorno-Karabakh is officially part of Azerbaijan and that their country has every right to reassert control.
Yeah, well, there's a very important distinction here.
Thomas Duval is a senior fellow at Carnegie Europe, specializing in Eastern Europe and the Caucasus. He explains that this conflict traces back to the fall of the Soviet Union, when a full-scale war broke out between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Duval says that Armenians do have a rightful claim to Nagorno-Karabakh itself.
But during the war, the Armenian side captured a huge amount of territory which was not part of Karabakh. It had no Armenians living there. It was pure, normal Azerbaijani administrative regions. So this is basically occupied territory by the Armenians.
That might help explain why the public in Azerbaijan is so supportive of this military campaign. But Armenians around the world don't see it that way. One of the largest populations of Armenians outside the country is in Los Angeles. Alex Galitsky is with the Armenian National Committee.
Primarily the feeling in our community here in Los Angeles, but across the country and throughout the world, is one of frustration.
Frustration that the international community has not done enough to condemn Azerbaijan and Turkey, the countries that Alex sees as the aggressors in this conflict. He says Armenians in LA feel a strong connection to Nagorno-Karabakh.
Not a single member of our community is untouched by what's happening. Those who've migrated here recently, they will have family who have been conscripted and are facing conscription. So I have many close friends who have volunteered to go to the front line.
Armenians in the U.S. and across the diaspora have raised tens of millions of dollars for the cause. Volunteers are collecting supplies and sending humanitarian aid to Armenia. People on the other side are also organizing. Arzuge Bula is a journalist from Azerbaijan, and she's based in Istanbul, Turkey.
There's been so much support for the government's decision to go into this war from abroad and from within the country.
Gebula says that a parallel conflict has broken out over Nagorno-Karabakh. It's about fundraising, but it's also an information war between the diasporas. Arzu left Azerbaijan in 2010. She says that when it comes to the fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh, there's not much space for honest discussion. If you deviate even slightly, she says, from the official position, online trolls will come after you.
I've been targeted before, but I think this is on a very different level. It's hard when it's happening, but it's harder when it's happening from the people that you know, like your people that you consider friends.
Gebula says even friends she's known for years have gone after her online. She says it all feels personal because in Azerbaijan, the Karabakh region is seen as part of the homeland.
Karabakh is part of every Azerbaijani's identity. In history textbooks, it's taught by your history teachers. It's very much engraved into your mentality that we are a victim and that Armenians are our enemies. And this is what they've done to us.
Gebula says this appears to be true on both sides, among Armenians and Azerbaijanis. And she says she worries there's no room for reconciliation.
I almost feel like first we need to stop the war, and then we need to rebuild trust among the people within each country, and then we can rebuild trust between the people from both countries.
But that kind of work takes time, and it takes compromise, something that at this point, neither Armenia or Azerbaijan appears to be willing to offer. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Italy had been the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak in Europe. For months now, Italy seemed to have the disease under control, but this weekend the country recorded its highest infection rate yet since the start of the pandemic, and today Italians are facing a whole new bunch of restrictions. Meanwhile, in Slovakia, everyone over the age of 10 is to be tested for the virus over the next couple of weeks. And in the UK, people in Wales are heading for a firebreak COVID lockdown. For the latest across the continent, our Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, joins us from London. So we'll get to the meaning of a firebreak COVID lockdown in a moment, Orla. But you and I were talking a week ago about the new restrictions being brought in across Europe. It seems a lot changes with the pandemic in one week.
Yeah, even last Monday, Marco, when we were talking, I told you that the Czech Republic was closing its bars and restaurants at 8 o'clock that evening. Less than 24 hours later, the entire industry was closed down and schools have been switched to online learning. So that just shows the pace at which things are changing here. The Czech Republic currently has the highest rate of new coronavirus infections, so it's really having to take stricter measures. In other countries like in Spain, a 15-day state of emergency is now in place in Madrid and surrounding areas. Today in Belgium, a new 4-week lockdown has been ordered. And in the Netherlands, they're also now under a 4-week lockdown. And France, as we mentioned last week, we now have 9 cities in France that are facing a curfew starting from 9 o'clock each night.
Not encouraging at all. And then there's Italy, which recorded one of the worst death rates in Europe from the disease. And it seemed to have gotten a handle on the coronavirus over the last few months. What went wrong?
You know, in the US, the sort of first terrifying images of the effect of the pandemic came out of New York. And for us in Europe, those images came from northern Italy and from the Lombardy region, where you saw the bodies piling up essentially and the coffins lining up. The speculation is that Italians themselves were so shocked at what happened that they complied pretty much with the government restrictions ever since then. So mask wearing, for example, is compulsory in public in Italy, and it's quite strict and people just comply by it. Now, in the last few weeks, unfortunately, we've seen those figures change again and the infection rate going up. And actually yesterday, the Prime Minister came out and said we're going to have to introduce new restrictions.
And in Slovakia, Orla, the plan is to test everyone. When does that start? How long is it going to take? And if Slovaks really don't have a choice in the matter, how's their government explaining it to them?
Yeah, this is an interesting measure. It was an announcement by the Prime Minister on national television on Saturday, and he said the only way to get a grip on the virus is mass testing, which I guess a lot of people would agree with. But then he pledged over the next 2 weekends to test everyone in Slovakia over the age of 10. The population of Slovakia is around 5.4 million. And he said if he didn't manage to do this, he would tender his resignation. And whether it's going to be mandatory or not, he hasn't said. Now, already in Bratislava on Saturday night, there were protests outside the parliament building and people saying that they weren't going to obey with the current restrictions that are in place. So I can't imagine that he will get all of the population to agree to testing, but we'll have to wait and see.
Closer to home to you, Orla, there are more lockdown restrictions coming into force in Britain, a so-called firebreak COVID lockdown for Wales. What is that?
Yeah, I mean, we had been expecting that it was going to come into place here. They call it a firebreak lockdown or a circuit break lockdown. Essentially, it's trying to stop the virus in its spread for a period of weeks by making sure that everybody stays at home and keep numbers down then who are going into hospital or needing to get into intensive care, and just give the healthcare services a bit of a break.
The World's Orla Barry in London with a look at the worrying surges of COVID-19 across Europe. Thank you very much, Orla.
You're welcome, Marco.
Have you ever watched an old Disney classic and cringed, like seeing how indigenous people are presented in Peter Pan, for example? Disney has faced some backlash in recent years for racist imagery. About a year ago, it began giving some of its films a disclaimer for outdated cultural depictions. Now Disney is strengthening that message. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier with more.
For decades, Walt Disney movies have all begun the same way. The sound of the opening animation transports people around the world back to childhood. But now, some of the classic Disney films are getting a new pre-movie message, a content advisory warning about racism. It reads, "This program includes negative depictions and/or mistreatment of people or cultures. These stereotypes were wrong then and are wrong now." The warning comes up on Disney Plus, the company's streaming service, and viewers can't skip past the message. It stays on screen for 12 seconds, running before a handful of movies like Peter Pan, Dumbo, and The Jungle Book. Disney didn't respond to my request for comment on how these films were selected, but their website says they collaborated with organizations like the African American Film Critics Association and the Coalition of Asian Pacifics in Entertainment to sift through the back catalog of films. Acknowledging the racist imagery with an on-screen warning is important, but the movies are still rated G and are watched by young kids who might not even know how to read. It's also a silent message, just white letters on a black screen. People may miss the advisory entirely.
I mean, you turn the movie on, it's 12 seconds of that, let me get my popcorn.
Hemant Shah is a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He studies portrayals of race and ethnicity in film and media.
I don't think the impact on consumers, in this case kids, will be that significant because it's not accompanied by a broader educational program about racism and racist stereotypes.
Shaw says, in addition to the disclaimer, Disney could provide teaching materials to parents so they could talk to kids about why these scenes were created in the first place.
Or why were they culturally acceptable in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even up to the 90s? What work did they do to keep people of color, you know, depicted in a negative way? And what impact did that have on their lives? I think that would be much more effective than only a 12-second disclaimer.
That sentiment is being echoed by many online. Some are saying the films should be removed entirely, while others say Disney is virtue signaling their support for anti-racism and human rights. Just last month, the studio received criticism for filming parts of Mulan in the same Chinese province where Uyghur Muslims are being forced into internment camps. But others applaud the entertainment titan for naming the racism in their past and committing to change, as the company does in this video on their website.
What message are we sending to little kids at the most vulnerable age if characters are one-dimensional, stereotyped, sidelined, hypersexualized, or simply not there at all?
Disney's advisory warning directs viewers to a site called Stories Matter, where people can find this PSA-like video.
There's always been a challenging conversation around how the media represents black people and what that representation should be.
That representation is to be determined. Disney hasn't yet published detailed plans on how they'll combat the forces of racism and xenophobia in their programs. But people are holding more and more corporations accountable. And it's clear the Walt Disney Company will be no exception. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Every morning, our newsroom discusses and debates the most important international news we need to cover. If you want a seat at the table, just subscribe to our morning newsletter, Top of the World. You can sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. An island nation divided for decades, Cyprus has now elected a hardliner in its Turkish north, but it doesn't bode well for reunification of the island.
You need a perfect alignment of the stars, because there are too many actors involved.
Also ahead, bootlegging booze is killing people in Turkey. That's still coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Thailand's officials are doing nearly everything they can to stop a growing protest movement against the government. They've locked up more than 50 protest leaders, many of them college students. They've threatened anyone who demonstrates with 2 years in prison. They've also sprayed peaceful crowds with a stinging blue liquid. None of this, though, appears to be working. In fact, as we're about to hear from the world's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok, the protests are only getting bigger and more defiant. Patrick, you've been out covering this movement. What's the mood at these protests?
Very youthful, defiant, as you said, and totally fed up with the government, but also quite disciplined and polite, Marco. So if you go to these protests, you won't see any weapons or any tough guys. You'll see a lot of students, some wearing their college or even high school uniforms. And there's this vibrant sense of solidarity. Last night, I watched several thousand students block one of Bangkok's busiest roads, just sitting down in traffic in the middle of the road. And then they were calling everyone watching to come join them. And so what they're saying there is, Long Ma, Long Ma, come on down, trying to coax people sitting on the sidelines or watching from a nearby bridge to come sit with them, saying, you know, join us, don't be afraid. And many people did. So they blocked the road for a few hours and just went home. And this sort of thing happened all over the country. Tens of thousands of people in many dozens of provinces just sending a message that, hey, even though you say we can go to prison for doing this, we're doing it, government, your move. And the protesters say they're going to keep popping up in random places, defying the government to stop them.
What do the demonstrators and the whole movement want?
Well, they have three demands. Get rid of the prime minister. That's number one. That's Prayut Chan-o-cha, and he's a former army general who came to power 6 years ago through a military coup. And Thailand has had more than a dozen military coups. And in general, the army likes to promote this very conservative, very obedient mindset in the country, which the students don't like. Number two, they want to reform the constitution, basically rewriting the whole power structure, which upholds what they would call a feudal society. And then there's the third demand, which is hugely transgressive by Thai standards and has honestly left a lot of people's jaws hanging open. They're asking to reform the Thai monarchy, which is, you know, all students in Thailand are taught. The monarchy is the pinnacle of Thai society. You do not critique it in any way or else you can go to prison.
So give us a little bit more information about the movement's vision for the monarchy. What do they mean by reform?
Yeah, it's not a full-on assault on the monarchy. It's a demand to change the monarchy's role in society. So in Thailand, it's blasphemous and legally quite dangerous to make demands of the monarchy, period. So a lot of the protesters have targeted this and said that this should change. When I asked one of the protest leaders named Rung how the movement hopes to reform Thailand's monarchy, she said this. So she says she would prefer the laws surrounding the monarchy to be more like the UK or Japan, where the royal institution doesn't play quite as prominent a role in society. And I should point out that that young woman is now in prison on sedition charges.
Mm. Patrick, with the Thai government threatening to lock up people who protest and their efforts to stop them in the streets, where do you see this movement going next?
Well, short term, the protesters are full of energy, and they will keep coming out. They feel it's this now or never moment. As for the government, they have tried to suppress the movement in so many ways, shutting down the train system in Bangkok so you can't get to the protest. Today, they said they're blocking certain online media outlets that cover the protest. So there is more that they could do, but it's more like, you know, rubber bullets using violence. And hopefully it won't come to that. But at some point, it feels like something has to break.
The world's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. Thanks very much for the update, Patrick. We'll check back in soon.
Thanks, Marco.
In Turkey, dozens of people have died after drinking tainted moonshine, illegally produced alcohol spiked with a deadly industrial chemical. It's one of several outbreaks of bootleg alcohol deaths this year globally. Duru Biskaran in Istanbul has more.
On a rainy Saturday afternoon, Istanbul's Beşiktaş district is bustling with students and crowded cafes. Outside a liquor store, a young man sells lottery tickets in front of shelves stacked with wine bottles. He tells me the prices through a translator. There's 60 to 90 liras for a bottle of Turkish wine. That's roughly 10 US dollars. and it's more for imports.
Mesela 35'lik Valentine's bir viski 95 lira.
For example, Valentine's whiskey, 35cc is 95 liras.
That's actually a lot of money for most Turkish workers. Right now, the economy is in a downturn, but the price of alcohol keeps rising. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's conservative government has tripled taxes on alcohol in the past decade, hoping to discourage drinking. The man selling lottery tickets, who didn't want to give his name, says alcohol prices are at a breaking point. Some people, he says, are starting to make their own alcohol at home or buying it illegally, and that carries its own dangers. On October 9th, a hospital in the seaside city of Izmir reported the death of a man poisoned with methyl alcohol, a cheap industrial chemical sometimes mixed into illegally produced liquor to cut the cost. It's odorless and flavorless, and less than a tablespoon of the stuff can kill you. Before long, Turkish doctors were reporting bootleg alcohol poisonings all around the country. The victims who survived were often left with permanent blindness or brain damage. 55 people died in 1 week, more than the total number of reported methyl alcohol deaths in Turkey for the 2 years before. Turkish authorities have jumped into action, raiding warehouses and going after underground traffickers. State media reported that more than 70 people have been taken into custody. But Turkey isn't alone. This spring, hundreds died in Iran after rumors circulated that drinking high-proof alcohol could prevent coronavirus. In a country without a legal alcohol market, that rumor turned deadly. All told, the year of coronavirus may be the worst year for methyl alcohol poisonings since researchers like Dr. Knut Erik Hovda of Oslo University Hospital started to track it.
So I think that there is a recreational element to the fact that people are not at work and they're home and they're drinking alcohol or they have lost their jobs and they're drinking because of that.
This year, he's tracked outbreaks of methyl alcohol poisonings in at least 25 countries, including India, the Dominican Republic, and the United States. The pandemic has disrupted alcohol smuggling routes, Hovda says, pushing illicit dealers to find local substitutes. Hovda fears methyl alcohol is becoming a more popular choice because it's widely available and cheap.
So that we know that the problem can just escalate much more than it is now even.
Methyl alcohol poisoning can also happen accidentally if someone who's distilling their own hard alcohol does so improperly. Making your own wine or beer does not carry this risk. But Yalçın Ongoran, a homebrewer in the town of Edirne, says drinkers here are on alert.
When I started homebrewing, I served my beer to other people. They were like, are you sure that this is not going to get me blind?
When booze becomes unaffordable, some do cut back on drinking, but others find another way. Ongoran has watched a Facebook group he runs for homebrewers grow to more than 600 members. Lately, though, their discussions have focused on the difficulties of finding specialized ingredients and equipment in Turkey.
We actually had problems with the customs this year. We couldn't find any yeast. We couldn't find any beer kits. And people were like, what are we going to do?
While Ongoran enjoys making beer, he worries about the people who, because of increasing taxes and a bad economy, feel pushed to make their own liquor. It's a riskier process and an illegal one. For The World, I'm Dari Biskaran in Istanbul.
Celebrations after midnight last night in Bolivia's capital, La Paz, when exit polls there showed the country's Socialist Party far ahead in the presidential election. The votes still have to be confirmed, but centrist candidate Carlos Mesa conceded to socialist candidate Luis Arce.
Conocer que ha habido un triunfador en esta elección y establecer nuestra lógica.
Joining me to discuss the news is Carwell Bjork James, a cultural anthropologist and Bolivia expert at Vanderbilt University. The party that seems to have won this election is the Movement Towards Socialism. They lost power last year, but have been able to regain it this year. How did that happen?
In the 2019 election, you had a somewhat closer margin of victory in the official results, as well as in the rapid count. And those two things set off 3 weeks of protest. Eventually, those protests accumulated into calls for Morales to resign, which he did under pressure of a police mutiny and advice from the military high command. So it was a constellation of forces that pushed Evo Morales out of power in early November 2019, that swept in President Jeanine Añez to be interim president of Bolivia for what we assumed then would be 90 days, but now has become 11 and a half months.
So this election this weekend was actually a do-over from last year's election. What does it say to you, Carwell, that this party, the Movement Towards Socialism, was able to regain power without Evo Morales, its former leader?
The Morales party is actually the party of its grassroots base. They were able to perform better in 2020 under the leadership of Luis Arce, the finance minister, who's kind of the face of the socialist-leaning economic development program of the Movement Towards Socialism. And I think these elections point to the deep and broad support for the Movement Towards Socialism. Winning by 20% shows that many people who had defected from voting for the party have returned to the party and returned to it very dramatically.
Hmm. Jeanine Añez Chávez, you mentioned, the interim president, was also running for president. She is U.S.-backed. She's right-wing. What has the last year under her presidency been like?
That year had a very painful beginning when protesters opposed to Morales's ouster were in the streets across the country, and they were confronted with military force at Añez's orders. At least 25 people were killed by security forces during those initial 2 weeks. You continue to see a lot of military deployments in January when she announced her run for the presidency that came on the heels of, 70,000 troops being deployed into Bolivian cities in a kind of show of force against potential protests. That was a big stake in militarization and kind of an authoritarian turn. And yet that does not seem to have swayed the Bolivian public.
Got to remember that Luis Arce is the former finance minister under Evo Morales. How much has the Socialist Party changed under Luis Arce's campaign? And what's socialism going to look like now in Bolivia?
I think that there are some challenges for socialism going forward, both in terms of fiscal crisis that is going to accompany the world's economic crisis, as well as excavating from a pandemic that has hit Bolivia really hard. Arce is proposing a payment freeze to be agreed with creditors and also a wealth tax for the first time. So we may see economic restructuring towards socialism in some ways, but it really depends on the balance of power between the Arce government and its international creditors, how much room it's going to have to continue to advance the nationalization of major industries and the provision of a generous welfare state.
Carwell Bjork-James at Vanderbilt University. He's an expert on social movements in Bolivia. Thank you very much for being with us, Carwell.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
People on the island nation of Cyprus woke up today to some important election results. Ersin Tatar was elected president of the Turkish side of the island. A little background here. Cyprus has been divided along ethnic lines for nearly 50 years. Turkish Cypriots in the north, Greek Cypriots in the south. Reunification talks led by the UN have failed for decades, but Tatar's new election could determine if and how things start to move forward. The world's Lydia Manolidou is on the line with us from Athens, Greece. Lydia, tell us about this presidential race and the winner, Ersin Tatar.
Yeah, so Marco, as you said yesterday, Turkish Cypriots narrowly voted into office Ersin Tatar. Political analysts I spoke to describe him as a nationalist, a hardliner on the right. He's closely aligned with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. In fact, Erdogan backed him in this race. Tatar ran against incumbent Mustafa Akinci. Akinci is a moderate who supported a peace deal to reunify the two sides and who also wanted Turkey to have less control in the region. Marco, I should say, Cyprus is a really politically complicated place, but I need to make it clear that the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, which is where Ersin Tatar was voted to lead, it's only recognized by Turkey itself. The government based in the Greek Cypriot side in the south is the one that's internationally recognized as the legitimate government, and it's recognized by everyone except Turkey.
So the recent history of Cyprus and the face-off between the two sides of the island, it is really complicated. Briefly, though, Lydia, remind us how Cyprus ended up in the position where it is, divided along ethnic lines.
Right. So Cyprus was a British colony that got its independence in 1960. That's when Greece, Turkey, and Britain signed a treaty.
By which, after 82 years of British administration, Cyprus formally became a republic.
Britain got to keep two sizable sovereign bases on the island, which it still has to this day. Turkey and Greece agreed that Cyprus would be an independent nation. But then in the 70s, the military junta that was ruling Greece at the time staged a coup to make Cyprus part of Greece.
erected at a Greek National Guard camp just beside the Turkish enclave.
And then Turkey invaded to prevent that and occupied about a third of the island in the north. And today there's a UN-enforced buffer zone between the two sides. It's called the Green Line. And this, Marco, is one of the longest-running peacekeeping missions in the world.
So as you said, the winner of this weekend's election, Ersin Tatar, does not support the two sides uniting under one government. This is what he had to say after yesterday's election.
We have to be very careful in international talks because any movement that will trap us into a game that at the end of the day will cut our link with Turkey.
Yeah, so it sounds like he's a little hesitant on reunification. What happens to reunification efforts moving forward, though, Lydia?
Well, what Tatar wants is to maintain separate administrations on the island. And this is actually a vision that's backed by Turkey. In terms of potential peace talks in the future, I spoke about this with Sertaç Sonan. He's a political scientist at the Cyprus International University. And before we go any further, he had this disclaimer.
I'm here as a political scientist, but also a heartbroken, disappointed campaigner.
So he's an analyst, but he's also a Turkish Cypriot who supported and campaigned for Akinci, the incumbent who was voted out.
What really makes this recent election result so depressing is the fact that the longer this division continues, the more permanent division starts to look.
So he says Tatar's election makes divisions more permanent.
Right. And he said that there's a reason why reunification efforts have failed time and time again, because in order for reunification to work,
you need a perfect alignment of the stars because there are too many actors involved. I mean, Turkish Cypriots, Greek Cypriots, Greeks, Turks, UK as a guarantor power. Even, I mean, we can add the EU and United States.
Yeah, he said a perfect alignment of the stars. Can't imagine that'll be easy. What with lots of different players, each with their own stakes in the region?
Exactly. I mentioned earlier, Marco, that Britain has two sovereign bases on the island where it has military bases and installations. And given Cyprus's location, they're considered really a key part of NATO's defensive system. So the UK, the US, and other NATO members have a lot at stake. And the terms of whatever deal would come forward would need to be agreed upon by lots of people. And then there are the Greek Cypriots on the island in the south, and they have been really against any reunification efforts. So add Tatar to the mix, and Sonan, the professor, said he just doesn't see a way forward for any sort of peace deal anytime soon.
The World's Lydia Emanalidou speaking with us from Athens, Greece. Thank you very much, Lydia.
Thanks, Marco.
A UN arms embargo on Iran is expiring. The ban on buying and selling conventional weapons has been in place for over a decade and is being lifted despite protests from the U.S. Meanwhile, the news comes as Iran struggles with both COVID-19 and an economy hard hit by American and international sanctions. Nesan Rafiti has been following this. He's an Iran analyst at the International Crisis Group and joins us from Washington. So a 13-year arms embargo lifted. How big a deal is this, Nesan?
It depends on your interpretation of the international law around this. As far as the U.S. is concerned right now, the embargo hasn't been lifted. According to the U.S., it successfully carried out a snapback move at the Security Council and basically prevented the expiration of the embargo. But as far as Iran is concerned, as far as most members of the Security Council are concerned, over the weekend, these restrictions on tanks, on combat vehicles, artillery systems, aircraft, helicopters, and so on, did lapse.
Without the embargo, I mean, if Iran goes on a buying spree, they'd need a lot of money. Do you think they will do that, given the state of their economy?
So funnily enough, the Iranian Foreign Ministry over the weekend, when they issued a statement, specifically said, we're not going to go on a spree. So it is possible that they will be looking to purchase some systems down the line. U.S. intelligence has, you know, pointed at the possibility of Iran looking at tanks or fighter systems from the Russians or the Chinese. In the short term, the impact economically of the sanctions, of COVID, of the economic mismanagement that they have is not a particularly robust picture, especially for making, you know, multi-billion dollar systems anytime soon.
Yeah, obviously a lot of this is dependent on the Iranian economy. So let's talk about the situation inside Iran. They're struggling with both COVID and economic sanctions. The U.S. added a new round of sanctions on Iranian banks just recently. How have all these sanctions impacted people's lives in the country, like daily lives?
The IMF just in the past few days put out its most recent report on regional economies, and Iran's GDP growth is predicted to contract by 5% this year. That follows on another contraction last year, and we've seen the currency, the rial, basically smash through one record after another when it comes to the exchange rate with the dollar. The positive news, in a sense, from Tehran's view, is that the IMF estimates are also that next year will be going back to growth, but the economy would be starting from a much smaller base than it was, 2 years ago before the sanctions really kicked in.
And if we just look at the coronavirus, the U.S. claims humanitarian and medical purchases are exempt, and so they're not subject to sanctions. But is that what you're seeing?
It's certainly true that the exemptions exist on paper. But what we have seen over the past several months, especially during the COVID outbreak, is that NGOs and some of the governments that trade with Iran are reporting bottlenecks when it comes to this type of trade. And the reason is that, the exemption may exist on paper, but convincing a pharmaceutical company or convincing a bank to process the transactions is a bit of an uphill struggle when everything is sanctioned and the threat of kind of penalties looms over anyone trading with Iran. So the latest U.S. sanctions are specifically targeting Iran's financial sector. And that has obviously increased concern, again, that any kind of chilling effects will be particularly important in the middle of a public health crisis. Those sanctions, which were announced a few weeks ago, have a 45-day grace period. So they'll technically kick in towards the end of November.
Nehsan Rafiti, Iran analyst at the International Crisis Group. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Marco. Thanks.
A community in Dingle, Ireland, is worried, extremely worried. Their favorite resident has gone missing. Fungi the dolphin was last seen about 6 days ago, and now a massive dolphin search is underway. Caroline Boland of the Dingle Peninsula Tourism Alliance is with us. Has Fungi ever been missing before?
Fungi might go quiet, for a couple of days, but would always reappear. So this is the first time that he has gone missing for such an extended number of days.
I know lots of people go to this part of Ireland to get a sighting of Fungi. Sometimes they're lucky and they see the dolphin, sometimes they don't. What does Fungi mean to the local community?
Well, I need you to imagine the Dingle Peninsula about 25 years ago, at least, when it was very, very quiet. There was little to no tourism here. And it was a fishing community and still is a fishing community sitting out 50 miles into the Atlantic Ocean. So 37 years ago, this wild dolphin suddenly appeared around the mouth of Dingle Harbour. And from that time, slowly the local community, particularly the fishermen, start engaging with him. And over the years, he has become probably our most famous ambassador. He is deeply loved by all the community here, has so many connections, not only as well with the community, but with people who have come from not only across Ireland, but across the world to come and see this extraordinary dolphin who decided to make Dingle Harbour and Dingle Bay his very own home.
So Fungi showed up 37 years ago. How old is Fungi? Do we know?
So approximately, experts say that he would be approximately 45, in around 45 years old. They reckon he was quite young when he came here. And there's lots of stories of why he came and he settled here. But one lovely one is that he would have arrived with his lifelong partner. And unfortunately, she didn't make it or maybe slipped away. But Fungi chose to stay. And he has become a part of the heart and soul of Dingle and is creating such, sadness and worry across the community at this time.
There is a possibility that maybe Fungi reached the end of his life. Are people talking about that?
I think it's still so raw. It's like losing a loved one, a family member. Fungi was more than all of us. He brought this spirit, this joy, wonder, the purity of just his goodness, always giving to the local community and to visitors that came here. And I suppose we're still in denial. We're ever hopeful that he might reappear. But you know, with every day that goes by, there's a growing concern that he may have slipped away, you know, onto his next adventure, as one of the local boatmen has said.
Well, Caroline, we're sending all of you in Dingle good vibrations for the return of Fungi the dolphin real soon. Caroline Boland of the Dingle Peninsula Tourism Alliance in Dingle, Ireland. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you.
And wishing you well too, Fungi. That is our show for this Monday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world. From PRX.